Schwitters began building the Merzbau Hanover by putting all the Merz pieces that had been in other rooms, in his flat and in the house of his parents, into one room, and he started to build one environment from this material. This was happening around about 1927, and we know this from letters. Then, in 1931, his father died, and his father, until this point, had been a problem. He'd not been enthusiastic about the Merzbau, as it was Schwitter's parents' flat that he was building into. Finally, when his father died, Schwitters was more or less free to become more active with his Merzbau. He also inherited some money from his father, and he used this to employ some craftsmen to help him transform his Merzbau into this large white construction we know of today. He also employed a professional electric installation to help him improve the structure. Schwitters had included dozens of small lamps into the Merzbau, but they kept blowing up, so as soon as Schwitters had money, he could invest in the Merzbau, developing it over 2 or 3 years. The original and most accurate source of information on Merzbau is, of course, Kurt Schwitters. His sketches, his writings, all help with this. After this, you also have a lot of memories from Ernst and from Schwitters' family. But all of these sources are very contradictory. It's very hard to say which is the right one, but you can try to find out the facts. For instance, there is one story that says Merzbau grew through the ceiling to all these levels, but it's not true. Perhaps an artist friend of Schwitter's once wrote that because that was the impression that he had had, but it wasn't a fact. We know this because there was an old lady who lived between the flat of Kurt Schwitter's and the flat of his parents. She lived there her whole life, and so on ground floor were his parents, on the second floor other people, and above that Schwitter's, but there was no Merz in between. So if you believe every person who recalls his memories after 50 years, it's a problem. And for historical researchers and art historians, you have to go to many different sources for this to work. And if you rely on one son, well, you have a problem.
Hello, I'm Callie Spooner, and this is Resonance FM. And I'm here with Jesse Ash and the artist Florin Rothmeyer, plus a contribution from the curator Hannah Nurali and the artist Peter Jocelyn in a programme that we're calling The Movable Column. Kurt Schwitters is generally acknowledged as the 20th century's greatest master of collage, but for 13 years between 1923 and 36, he also worked on a construction that came to be known as the Merzbau. The Merzbau in Hanover was a fantastically constructed interior formed from bus tickets, wrapping paper, newspapers, artworks, and later specially designed constructivist-style structures and found objects. The Merzbau could be described as a 3D collage, and Schwitters worked on it continuously in his own home until it spread to 8 rooms of his house in Hanover, then eventually to a hut in Norway and a barn in England. Merzbau was on principle an uncompleted work, but for the Hanover permutation was destroyed in Allied bombings and then much later reconstructed by the Swiss theatre designer Peter Beisiger and the curator Harold Zeman from 3 black and white photos of one of the 8 rooms in 1981. On our last show, the British sculptor Richard Wentworth came on to talk about reconstructing destroyed objects and photographing his sculpture. And before this, Ben Kane joined us to play a never-ending sound work. And this week, Florian is here to tell us about a replica of the Alta Maria, is that right?
Alta Maria.
Alta Maria. Cave paintings, which are approximately dated around 13,000 BC.
That's right, yeah.
So you've got a picture.
Yes, I've brought in a picture in a magazine from the 80s, actually. The magazine is called Culture and Technik, Kultur und Technik. And it's published by the German Technical Museum in Munich. And there is a really nice picture of the original installation of a replica section of the Altamira cave as it was installed in the museum in the early, well, this work started in the 50s and the installation was finished in the 60s. And what you see in the image is a sort of stone-clad room, the sides, the walls are stone-clad, and a floating 44 square meter replica section of the Altamira cave. And the originally this room was conceived as sort of the center exhibit in a new section in the technical museum, and the section was chemistry, and the uses and applications of chemistry. And the idea was that the idea of the museum is that their exhibit should be very much experiential. That means you should have an experience of the application of any technical processes. Hence, sort of the idea of what is an early version or an early form of chemistry being applied. And the idea, or the original idea, was to go back to the very, very early stages, which was or was considered to be the application of pigments in cave paintings. The idea of this replica started in the 50s, and I've done some research in the museum archives, and it was actually one of the most ambitious works that was ever undertaken in this museum. The whole process took about 10 years. The starting point was a segment of the Altamira cave in Spain, because this particular piece or this particular section of the cave painting was very three-dimensional. That means it's not a flat ceiling. It was a sort of very relief ceiling, sometimes ranging by about a meter. And because you couldn't just represent it in two dimensions, the idea was to create a one-to-one replica with all the relief elevations and sort of dents and boulders sticking out. The process was to sort of agree with the Spanish government to make this one replica without touching the original ceiling. And the other agreement was to agree to make a second replica in Spain as a sort of trade for using one in Munich. Now, the sort of steps involved, the operations involved in creating this replica are incredibly elaborate, elaborate in terms of labor, in terms of finances, and in terms of just the sheer amount of time and effort that went into this. It started with stereophotogrammatic records of the original ceiling, and that was used because you weren't allowed to touch the ceiling. You had to use a new form of photography, which actually allows the recording of the elevation, normally used in sort of recording landscape. Because the ceiling was too close to the camera, they had to build a new camera to actually use this photographic system. These were then translated or produced into 1 square meter big enlargements. And from these enlargements, a plaster model was carved into plaster blocks, and they were carved in by 1 centimeter increments. And because the 1 centimeter increments weren't accurate enough, they were then covered in a 3 millimeter plasticine coat. And over the duration of 1 year, art students from the Art Academy in Munich actually sculpted into this 3 millimeter plasticine coating to get it absolutely identical, which was then re-photographed and compared on-site in Spain, whether there is ever so slight differences, and they were then corrected again in Munich. And of this model, of this sort of like positive model, the museum made a caoutchouc, a silicon caoutchouc mold, which was sort of just poured over the positive, which was at this point pointing upwards rather than downwards. And that was a completely new possibility at this time, technically completely new possibility to actually make a mold that size. But because the silicon was very elastic and it wouldn't have been keeping its shape once taken off the positive, they had to pour a layer of plaster on top of the silicon, which was then completely turned around 180 degrees and moved into the museum and into the room where the ceiling was eventually cast. Then a concrete factory in Germany developed a specific concrete mix, which was one-to-one identical to the mineral components of the rock in Spain. And funnily enough, the main component of this concrete mix is sand from Solnhofen. Solnhofen is a place in Germany which is quite famous for its stones which are used worldwide actually for litho printing. So this was the main ingredient of this concrete mix. And there's a nice analogy between the litho printing and the sort of recasting of this cave painting, actually. So the ceiling was eventually cast on top of this, was cast into the caoutchouc mold, the sort of full scaffolding with positive model and mold was removed. And the ceiling was then painted again by art students from the academy using mineral components that, again, were identical to the ones being used back then. And the room was completed with the sort of stone-clad walls around it. Was finished in the early 1960s. The room is still there because it cannot actually leave its current position.
It's stuck.
It's sort of fixed in place. The chemistry department, for which it was originally conceived, has since moved into another wing. So it's stuck in that space with nothing around it, and it cannot be taken out unless you want to completely destroy the ceiling itself. I was just, it's an amazing encounter to go there because you step from something very kind of like something you would normally encounter in a museum into this completely decontextualized environment, which is an incredible experience actually when you're on site.
It's such a, I don't fully understand. I mean, did they literally just put it in there to be able to produce a sort of an illustration or a signifier of the earliest form of chemistry? Was that what it was there? I mean, was it there as a sort of an illustration to show how pigment was first used in walls of cane painting? That was literally the reason why it was there.
That's exactly it. I mean, the early discussion around this was to use either a two-dimensional, either huge photographic print or a sort of drawing, rendering of an idea of cave painting. And instead they went for the most difficult and costly option possible at this point.
And why do you think they did go for that?
I talked to the curator in charge of looking after it now and the sort of legacy of it. And she explained to me that one of the big missions of this museum is to, on the one hand, record these sort of incredible technical innovations in history up to the present day. But the other aspect of the museum or the museum's mission is to do it in a very experiential way, and experiential on the one hand for the viewer or the sort of visitor to the museum to be really able to, through experience, participate in the application. But the other aspect of that experience means the sort of a reenactment of the application, if you like. The reenactment in a way to the technical possibility of the moment. Hence the sort of involvement of, in that case, chemistry applications, the caoutchouc silicon mold, which was a brand new material at this point, and the involvement of concrete firms, cement mixing firms that sort of like try to mix the sort of right mineral components together. So it's these three aspects of what application is, but also what experience is, and bringing these together.
So there's almost, a sense of choosing an example or an illustration, in this case the cave painting, which offers the possibility to demonstrate the chemical procedures of the time of making. So in a sense the process of making and the process of these technical relationships in a sense sort of represent the time of reproduction or representation, while trying to represent or illustrate something that happened many centuries back.
Yeah, I mean, it's a double celebration in a way, a celebration of the original presentation as well as the sort of euphoria and celebration of the possibilities of representation in that case, or really clearly sort of remaking the presentation. And it's this sort of double euphoria that's involved there.
I'm just wondering whether or not we should play another track, which is the archive curator in Hanover talking about the Merzbau, because I think there's something, some sort of interesting kind of parallels between perhaps why this cave painting was remade and why the Merzbau reconstruction exists. So I'll just play this track.
It's good to have the reconstruction because it's impressive, but it is only a reconstruction. From it, you can get an idea of how small the room was, and it is also a good place to tell visitors about Schwitter's idea of the Merz concept, of the fusing of private and public things, with art historical references, plus all the other things that he was thinking about and working on. All these interests are really summed up in this room. You can use his replica to explain, and if you stand in the Merzbau and describe and tell visitors about it, then hopefully the whole cosmos of his thoughts appears a little clearer. It's a stage. A stage is a good expression for this replica.
Okay, so I think that perhaps what they were trying to do with the cave painting was something similar, some sort of stage to be able to tell a story about the history of chemistry and to somehow create this theatrical experience of what that was in a way. But I mean, to me it just seems so arbitrary, particularly now because it's irrelevant to the room, particularly now because the room where it's stuck. I mean, what is the room used for now that this cave painting's stuck in?
They have the cave when the ceiling is exactly at the same position, but the room doesn't exist as such. Oh. In itself, you can imagine it as a big hall. And in this hall, they cast the ceiling. And then there is fake walls around the ceiling to create a room within that space.
Right.
So there's nothing around it as such. What they did since the 60s, they covered the original sort of stone walls with red plasterboards. And that's the only change that really took place. But there is, you know, it's almost like a fake space within a larger space to create this mm-hmm. idea of ceiling, of cave. And there's also a sort of tunnel-like entrance to sort of tune the visitor into the idea of you're going underground now and the sort of theatricality of entering a cave, mm-hmm. a cave space.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, going back to sort of when we went to visit the Merzbau in Hanover, and that sense of again arriving at a space that was quite sort of theatrical and felt like it was almost an annex in some way to the main museum. Mm. And you sort of arrive at this sort of room that was very much a piece of theatre, really, and seemed incredibly arbitrary in a way, or like it didn't necessarily need to be there. And I'm just sort of thinking about the theatricality, I suppose, of reconstructions in general and how the pretense of them, you know, that they are always kind of pretending, they're always an act of mimesis, how they're always somehow arbitrary, I suppose, in that sense. But what were your feelings about the Merzbau in Hanover in relation to what...
Well, I mean, you talk about theatricality and there's, in both these examples, I mean, from Florian's description and my memory of Merzbau Hanover, it's a stage, but it's empty, isn't it? I mean, there's the people that, when we saw it at least, we were sort of wandering around waiting for, there's this sense of waiting for something to happen, or an empty shell for something to about to happen, you know. And when you were talking about theatricality, I was also thinking about there's a theatricality of, or awareness, let's say, of your physicality or your presence in a space in relation to the thing, i.e. mm. the cave painting or Merzbau. But there's also a theatricality in relation to its production
yes.
as well, which comes before, and Florian took a long time explaining that and all these networks
yeah.
of production. And I think, you know, in relation, for me, that's, you've got these two things. One is the actual relationship with the thing or the object, whatever it is that we end up with in the institution. And then there is also the sort of performance, if you like, or the network or the social mm-hmm. relations that actually produce the work. And I think what I was really interested in was in the Merzbau, you've got all these different voices
You've got in the Merzbaz reconstruction.
Yeah, yeah. You've got Bizica. You've got
Bizica, like who is a Swiss theatre designer, who was brought in to rebuild it. So, and then we've got
there's Ernst
Schwitters, who was Kurt's son. So he was responsible for the memory. His memory of the Merzbau combined with Peter Weisiger's sort of technical expertise, if you like. There was the historians.
Yeah, there's a whole
network of people.
And Florian's talked about students creating stuff. He's talking about the Spanish government. He's talking about people in Munich. He's talking about the institution itself. And I was just thinking as well about this idea of the thing, i.e. that's used to represent the constructivist objects and shapes in Merzbau, or the actual cave painting in the reconstruction what Florian's talking about. And there's this little made me think a bit of Bruno Latour's writing, where he talks about the thing, or the history of that word, the thing or ding, D-I-N-G, which was originally a certain type of archaic assembly. So you've got this the idea that a thing is an object or a singular thing, but it's also seen in its in a way it's been looked at previously as an assembly of things. And I just wanted to quickly, if you don't mind. No, yeah, just
go for it.
Well, it's these two ways of thinking about representation. You know, we've got this cave in the institution. We've also got its production and the assemblage, the social assemblage anyway. So this is just quick, I'll get through this as soon as I can. So this is Latour writing, Bruno Latour writing in his essay From Realpolitik to Ding Politik. What we call an object-orientated democracy tries to redress this bias in much of political philosophy. That is, to bring together two different meanings of the word representation that have been kept separate in theory, although they have remained always mixed in practice. The first one, so well known in schools of law and political science, designates the ways to gather the legitimate people around some issue. In this case, a representation is said to be faithful if the right procedures have been followed. The second one, well known in science and in technology, presents, or rather represents, what is the object of concern to the eyes and ears of those who have been assembled around it. In this case, a representation is said to be good if the matters at hand have been accurately portrayed. Realism implies that the same degree of attention be given to the two aspects of what it is to represent an issue. The first question draws a sort of place, sometimes a circle, which might be called an assembly, a gathering, a meeting, a council. And the second question brings into this newly created locus a topic, a concern, an issue. But the two have to be taken together. So is this, I don't know about you guys, but I was just thinking about how we talk about this thing, and that the thing can also be the assembly.
Yeah.
The assembly of construction.
Within that, I don't know if this is going slightly off the point, but the thing that I found quite interesting was this notion of what it means to have a good representation. Like, you know, what does that amount to? And that one of the kind of the possibilities is sort of a faithfulness to the right procedures, to following the right procedures, or something like that. It made me think of like Walter Benjamin's The Task of the Translator, which I think I keep dropping into this program because it's an interesting one to think about, where he, in that particular short text called The Task of the Translator by Walter Benjamin, he talks about the notion of translation and what that kind of amounts to, and what a good translation of something is, or what a good translator should do, who's responsible for turning something from one state into another state, and what you need to be able to, what amounts to a good translation. And he says that rather than kind of creating a like-for-like correspondence of the original thing, it's very much more important to kind of crawl under the intentions of the original, or grapple with the intentions of the original, and somehow represent these, or somehow evoke these, knowing that perhaps what you produce is going to be very different to the original thing, but provided that you have kind of grappled with its original intentions in some way, whatever they may be, you will have a good translation, and that is kind of the good task of the translator. And I'm just sort of, to me, this is interesting in relation to the Latour, trying to pin down what, you know, you do need to do to create a good representation of something, the cave and then also Merzbau. Because for me, I don't know so much about the cave, I don't know how you feel about this, but for Merzbau, it's it didn't kind of grapple with the intentions of the original to me. Like, it didn't, you know, it wasn't faithful to the procedures that, you know, Merzbau came about from. It, the reconstruction is just replicating the final permutation of Merzbau, just the shell, the fossil, if you like. It is a fossil of the very last point when this was supposed to be kind of a moving, evolving process in some way. And so I suppose, but I don't know how that relates to the cave or the tour. It might be kind of a bit off-piste, but I just think this idea of trying to understand how you can get to grips with what you need to do to make something good in terms of representation and translation is
a confusing thing. The word you use, faith, I think. Mm. Faith, faithful, being faithful.
Faithful, yeah.
And I suppose what's that? That's an endeavour to try and be close to something to hold on to something. And
I mean, the idea of good representation or faith in this respect, or a sort of like coming close to something that might be true or faithful. This is all, of course, guesswork, you know, and all of this is sort of interpretable, and it might change from decade to decade as well. So I think, I don't know whether whether that's a really, in that case, a very sort of productive approach in looking at representations. And I think that's why I bring in this example of the cave as well, because, or this sort of cave replica, is because, you know, in the approach there wasn't necessarily to be truthful or being faithful with the original, because it's so far removed from our idea of what that really is and what this cave was used for and why making paintings in it, that the only thing left really is the sort of sheer mode of production without any sort of attempt of interpreting or sort of going to its sort of intention.
Because no attempt at faith. No attempt to be faithful.
Well, it's sort of the only faith that's there is the sort of production faith rather than the actual use or the employment of it or the... do you know what I mean? It's literally just a sort of technical process, a series of operations rather than a sort of place in life. So it's an approach for the coming into the world rather than a being in the world. Mm. And the sort of being in the world seems so open for discussion and interpretable that you can't ever understand it. So the only thing left is its process the process of coming into the world with all these sort of technical steps involved and completely sidestepping any sort of truth of translating, if you want, or a sort of good representation, if you want.
And that process or that coming in to the world was a 10-year period, 50 to 60.
Yeah, roughly late 50s to
the
60s.
So there was a 10-year coming into the world, if you like. But what is it now then? What is it after that process?
I think it's also, that's why I sort of said in the beginning, the sort of euphoria of making, or the euphoria of sort of celebrating the sort of moment of being able to represent something and celebrating the materiality of this representation. It's literally a sort of a crystal of its time. So and then it moves, and it's and again, it's sort of like it becomes a moment in time rather than something that lasts.
So it's the crystallization of a process of making between 50 and 60 rather than yeah. however many centuries ago.
Exactly. And what's left now is us looking at it and thinking, my God, how can they spend so much money, so much effort, you know, the incredible amounts of resources that went into this making, who for? And when you were talking about the stage for beforehand, I was wondering, what is being staged exactly? What is on that stage? Is it the sheer pleasure the people involved in making this had, the sort of actually celebrating themselves and their pleasure, almost childlike pleasure in being able to do this? You know, this, my God, you know, it's not cardboard anymore. We can have real stuff now, and, you know, we can take trains to go to Spain and look at this. You know, this sort of next step from being able to do something on scale in this case. It's probably the pleasure, the staging of their own pleasure at this point in
it's
making
a celebration of the cave.
It's a celebration of being able to do something that. Like this.
On that note, I'm going to play someone else's celebration of the cave, which is a song that's been sent to us by Peter Jocelyn, who is an artist who spends quite a lot of his time covering pop songs on GarageBand very well, but he hasn't covered this song, but he has sent us a song by Steely Dan called The Caves of Alta Maria, so I'll just play that for us now.
I recall when I was small how I spent my days alone. So I went and found my own. I would climb the garden wall with a candle in my hand. I'd hide inside a hole of rock and sand. On the stone, an ancient hand in a faded yellow green made alive a worldly wonder often told but never seen. Now and never bound to labor on the sea and in the sky. Every man and beast appeared, a friend as real as I. Before the fall, when they wrote it on the wall, when there wasn't even any Hollywood, they heard the call and they wrote it on the wall. For you and me, we understood. But history, can you see what has been done? Memory rush over me, now I step into the song. Before the fall, when they wrote it on the wall, when there wasn't even any Hollywood, they heard the call and they wrote it on the wall. For you and me, we understood.
Okay, so that was The Caves of Alta Maria by Steely Dan. we were just talking about, while that was playing, we were just talking a little bit about going back to this idea of fidelity to an original thing, and that perhaps one of the reasons why I have a problem with the Merseburg reconstruction. I can't speak for Jesse, or why we're sort of battling over the sort of the pros and the cons of this sort of cave painting ceiling, is because we're perhaps assessing these things in terms of, I don't know, whether or not they're good enough replicas of the original thing, whether they're kind of embodying the intentions of the original thing, whether or not they are, you know, they have faith to the original thing, one of the things we were just thinking was that maybe it's not necessary to think of it in those terms, and perhaps these are just completely new things, you know, that they've got nothing to do with the original anymore. Perhaps the Merzbau reconstruction is just a stage to talk about sort of Schwitters, but not necessarily about the Merzbau itself. Or maybe it's a useful thing now to talk about reconstruction. You know, maybe it's become a completely different object to the Merzbau, or maybe the ceiling is, you know, a completely different object to, of course, a completely different object to the cave, but maybe it's got, it's not about sort of fidelity to the original anymore. Mm. It's more to do with just creating something new by referencing something or something like
Florian,
that.
When Florian's talking about, you know, the there's this a sense of the reason why they chose such a difficult thing to reconstruct was, in a sense, because of it was going to keep them busy all these technical procedures for 10 years, which in themselves would have chemical and scientific questions which they could then answer and present. And it's, you know, I don't think it's a question at all of has it done a good job in representing something that existed before in both cases, Merzbau and the, what is it, how do you say it?
The Altamaria cave.
The Altamaria cave.
Altamaria.
I think it's more about this process. I know I keep going on about it, but I'm thinking of, we talked recently about the reconstruction of the Columbia shuttle, space shuttle in 2003, which, in a, you know, when it blew up over Texas, seven astronauts died, but there was this huge FBI process of excavation, finding different fragments in farms across, you know, plains in the South States of America, and then they were brought into a huge air hangar, and they were assembled with people with white coats. It took years and years, but there were the, what it really was a sort of a representation of the seriousness of putting things back together,
right,
to try and find an answer of why something happened. So it's much more, how I think about it anyway, is much more of a sort of an image of preciousness rather than actually the need to reconstruct it. And the same thing happens, I mean, you know, you could argue with Colin Powell's speech to go to war in Iraq, complete lies. But presented, it was the process of presentation to represent something which we knew at the time and definitely know now was wrong. Mm-hmm. So I think there's all these sort of like events of assembly and endeavor to represent rather than the actual thing. I think the actual thing just ends up being irrelevant.
I mean, I think that what kind of strikes me from this example is that, and I don't know the answer to this, but it's a question of what fills the place of fidelity, or what takes over from fidelity once this becomes debatable. Mm. When that's kind of thrown into question, and then there is no clear answer, what steps in, what takes the place of fidelity, and process or the sort of effort, you know, could be a sort of the reference, could be
a new fidelity.
Yeah, and it could also, I mean, that's why I said I don't know the answer to this. It could also be a scapegoat, or it could be an excuse as well. You know, it could be the sort of running away of, I'm going to keep myself busy for 10 years and then I know I've done enough to be truthful.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you can be incredibly difficult and labor intensive as an excuse to try and be as accurate as possible. Hence the sort of, why bother to make the ceiling that nobody knows about as sort of chemically and minerally identical to the original? Mm. What's, to what avail? You know, what is the purpose of this?
To me, it feels like a sort of showing off.
Showing off without knowing it, like nobody knowing though. I mean, who are you showing off to?
That's
a difficult one.
Who paid for it?
The museum is government funded.
The museum is government funded.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, was it ever sort of a status thing for them to sort of show that they had access to all these sort of fantastic ways of building and molding and making and shaping things? You know,
it's definitely an institution like this, yeah.
Right.
It's
and were they in sort of cahoots with, I don't know,
industry?
Industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So maybe, I mean, that's interesting, right? I mean, maybe in there, that's what I mean about showing off.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely tells a story about the institution itself and their sort of networking.
Yeah, and so were they sort of, they were working with maybe kind of chemistry companies, yeah. Maybe concrete companies, you know, maybe in, you know, all these sort of different things. I mean, it reminds me, I've sort of spoke about this a little bit before, but it reminds me of my dad used to work for, he used to sort of build big pharmaceutical labs, if you like, and I remember going to visit him at work once, and he was just doing the finishing touches to this sort of multi-million, billion-pound kind of space. And one of the things that they had outside was this sort of concrete monument of sorts, which was built through a number of different complex sort of systems that were testimony to the sort of the chemical achievements and skills of the company, and to demonstrate their wealth and so on. And it cost something insane, you know, I don't know, hundreds and thousands of pounds, let's say. I mean, absolutely loads of money. And it was literally a statement, you know, on their kind of wealth and their power, a monument of that sort of as a welcome, you know, sign, if you like, when you drove up to the venue to sort of, you know, it was a wealth status, if you like. And to me, the first thing I thought about when I saw that ceiling and I heard that it was sort of affiliated with industry in a certain respect was I thought of that, you know, little strange monument that they'd spent so much money on. And then again, not long after the project was finished, they moved, the company moved. And so this kind of monument that they'd left outside that was supposed to be a sign of the company and their achievements, again, was sort of redundant and had to be removed. And it seems to me very much about money and power and creating monuments to your achievements and your capabilities, and I feel this ceiling is doing that in a way.
But I think what's really interesting about that is the sort of materiality of those economic questions, or because, you know, there are hundreds and thousands of representations or re-presentations of things all the time, and I don't know, like Las Vegas, for example, reconstructions of New York and Paris, and but when you get up close to these reconstructions, you tap them, and they're made of, you know,
plastic
yeah. or yeah, yeah. you know, MDF. They're knocked up quick, so it changes. Mm. You know, the it's not about the process of making; it's about the image or the original. So, and I wonder if that's something to do, I'm not necessarily with the example you just said, Kelly, but there's this thing about the preciousness of what we determine as art as well, rather than maybe symbols of architecture, because the cave painting, however it might have been used as communication at that time, or a text, in fact. But both of the examples we're talking about are a process of making being reconstructed, aren't they? They're, you know, how we might see art. Well, maybe at this point, I might, because we're talking about materiality of buildings, and it might be a good moment to read a recipe, because it's Sunday lunch time, and hopefully this would be appropriate. It's the future from the Futurist cookbook, Marinetti's Futurist cookbook, in fact. And this is a small recipe for an architectural dinner for Santa Ilia. And I'm just going to read sort of halfway through it. To dine, they used their hands like children, and alternatively built and ate towers, skyscrapers, battleship guns, airport slipways, belvederes, sports stadiums, military pontoons, elevated railways, one after the other. 300 cubes, 3 centimetres high, of pastry. 8 parel pipeds, 10 centimetres high, of compressed buttered spinach. 10 cylinders, 30 centimetres high, of Cremona nugget. 6 balls, 15 centimetres diameter, of Milanese risotto. 5 pyramids, 40 centimetres high, of cold minestrone soup. 20 tubes, 1 metre high, of date paste. 5 ovoid blocks, 20 centimetres high, of banana paste. 7 screens, 60 centimetres high, of cod cooked in milk. The futurists, the better to construct the futurist house, perfected it with their teeth, each one sitting on indelible cylinders of compressed pasta. So there's a sort of funny recipe.
Sounds tasty.
Amazing.
I'm wondering whether or not we should just play a cover song, which is being given to us by Hannah Nurali, who is a curator, who has curated Florian in a show at MOT Gallery, which interestingly was a show that was very process-based. It was evolving over a year, really, with lots of artists dropping in and out of it. And I think within that show, were you kind of engaging in... you were working on a number of different pieces, is that right?
That's right,
where you
yeah.
were, and but you were quite... it was quite a material engagement, wasn't it? A process of sort of transformation of materials from one state to another.
That's how it started,
is that right?
Yeah, it was... I kind of contributed in three parts basically mm-hmm. throughout the year, one really early on, then again in the middle, and mm-hmm. one towards the end of last year. And it started with three very simple sort of process-based gestures. That was the first manifestation. And then they were sort of, well, I tried to recontextualize them afterwards. So I actually went back after doing or sort of executing these gestures in finding a context for them, sort of opposite to how you would normally work, sort of, you know, finding the context and then sort of the gesture to go with it. I was trying to do the opposite, actually rescuing sort of what might have been lost along the way, actually. Yeah, sort of retrospectively doing the work that should have gone before. And then as a sort of third manifestation, I tried to placed it within an experience, or the sort of experiential narrative around the sort of context. Mm-hmm. So actually, it sort of like turned a normal, or what I would think is a sort of normal working mode, the other way around, and reversed everything.
And that produced a number of different, that emerged a number of different forms, is that right?
That's
there was
right,
some
yeah.
sculptures in
yeah.
there, and there was some text,
a lot of sort of formats of documenting and accumulating, and at the end a very sort of spatial reconfiguring.
Nice. Well, this is a song from Hannah who made this reconfiguring possible, and it's a cover of R. Kelly's Ignition by Bonnie Prince Billy. So let's play this.
You remind me of something. I just can't think of what it is. Girl, let me stick my key in your ignition, babe. You think it's starting to get rolling, babe. Oh, I won't go to about 80 on your freeway. Girl, I won't stop until I drive you crazy. So buckle up, cause this could get bumpy, babe. Girl, we're gonna mess around and get a ticket, babe. Oh, buckle up, yeah. Back that thing up so I can wax it, babe. We're gonna mess around and get a ticket, babe, okay. We're off up in this Jeep. We gogging up the windows. We got the radio up. We all up in the back. We got the sh** bouncing. We're going up and down. And we're smoking and a drinking. Just a thug in it. And now hold, jumped up down. Once I hit them switches, babe, I'm about to take it where you wanna go, babe. Guarantee I'm about to get some knowledge, babe. And there won't be no running out of gas, babe. It's like, ooh.
pull over, babe, and let me put this love all up in your trunk, babe. So buckle up, cause this could get bumpy, babe. Oh, we're gonna mess around and get a ticket, babe, cause we're all up in this Jeep. We're fogging up the windows, we got the radio up, we're going up and down, and we got the shit bouncing. We're going up and down, and we're smoking and we're drinking, just a thugging it out. Now, hold tight, cause I'm about to go faster, babe. You're dealing with a pro behind this wheel, babe. So tell me, have you ever driven a stick, babe? You'll be screaming every time I shift those gears, babe. So brace yourself while I'm hitting those corners, babe. And when I'm done, put the cows up on your license plate. So buckle up, cause this could get bumpy, babe. Oh, we're gonna mess around and get a ticket, babe. Cause we're all up in the street and we're fogging up the windows. We got the radio up, we're all up in the back and we got the shit bouncing. We're going up and down and we're smoking and we're drinking, just thugging it out. When I hear you say
green light,
I'ma go
yellow light,
do it slow. When I hear you say,
switch lanes,
hit the signal,
pit stop,
take a break,
pit stop.
We're about to go real far. When you say,
green light,
I'ma go,
yellow light,
do it slow,
red light,
I'ma stop. When I hear you say,
switch lanes,
hit the signal,
switch lanes,
take a break,
pit stop.
Whoa! Cause we're hugging up the window. Hugging up the windows, we on the radio up, we're all up in the back, we got the shit bouncing, we're going up and down, and we're smoking and we're drinking, just a bugging it out.
So there we go. That was, who was that?
Will Oldham. Is that how he, yeah, it is Will Oldham, who is also known as Body Prince Billy, covering R. Kelly's Ignition, which is a very good example of a redo or a reconstruction that is very much not being particularly loyal to the original. I personally am a huge fan of the original, so
I'll put that on afterwards.
I'm a bit of an R. Kelly fan.
Yeah, fair enough. I think we all are, really. We're just thinking about where the site of experience of these things, because we've talked about the many reproductions and representations that we could think about, but in this case we are sort of trying to think about this cave. And we are thinking about Merseburg, and where you end up. And in both of those places, you're ending up in an institution, and in a, which is, I suppose, something which is designed to tell us things, or teach us things, or allow us to experience things. I was just thinking in relation to the cave painting. Just a minute ago, I was thinking about another attempt at reconstruction. But it was much, we're talking about theatricality, and I was thinking this is much more of a performative endeavour, I suppose. Quite a few years ago, maybe even 10 years now, Art Angel did a production with John Berger and Simon McBurney, where they got the audience to walk down into the old Aldwych tube station, which is now not it's disused. You went down there, and you went actually onto the track,
mm-hmm.
and you walked down the tunnel mm-hmm. into the darkness, and the lights were turned off. And then John Berger read a text. It was related to Anne Michael's book, I believe, called Fugitive Pieces, which was about memory. Crucially, you were in a tunnel, underground, in the darkness. You had no sight, but you had sound and you had a voice. And the voice described the cave paintings. I suppose I'm just trying to think about the site of reception of these reproductions, and that we're very much talking about reception within institutional context.
I mean, my question about the experience in representational reproductions is whether this is not the point where it all starts to go astray. The sort of at the moment where one is sort of let into a planned and organized experience, and whether that's not the moment where any sort of reproduction starts to fall apart, because it's sort of pre-mediated and it's not an offer anymore but a prescription. And whether the sort of attempt of a sort of truthful recreation of possible experience does not lead ultimately to a failure, because it's not because it's too prescriptive, or it's not in a way mediated or too mediated.
Mm. But when you're there, because you've been there, you've seen it, do you have any sense that it could be some cavity from above falling in through the room, or is it very evident immediately you walk in that this is just a complete fabrication?
It is immediately obvious that this is just a fabrication, yeah.
Mm.
And it's set up as such as well. It is, you know, what that is a presentation of a representation, and it really sort of celebrates this presentation aspect of representing something.
Mm.
Maybe some people just love things that aren't real, you know? I mean, maybe that's what this comes down to, a matter of taste. I mean, like, some people love Disneyland and things like that, and they love staying in the hotels there where everything is as plastic as the rides and as plastic as the kind of the trees and all the different bits and pieces. And some people actually maybe really just love things that aren't real.
But then that's art. That's art as well, isn't it? I mean, the whole relationship to art or experiencing art is there's a sort of contract where you are saying to someone else, i.e. the viewer, you know, maybe you need to be suspending your belief
yeah.
to a certain extent.
Yeah,
you know,
but Disneyland doesn't ever sort of pretend to be real. You know, they don't give you a trip of acid.
Mm.
So whereas this, in a way, still tries to do that.
Mm. Mm. But that's the context of science as well, I suppose, isn't it? I mean, how a science museum goes about something and how an art institution goes about something. I suppose that's different.
We're going to have to finish, I'm afraid, because we're running out of time. This is the movable column for people that have just tuned in near the end. This is part three, and we'll continue this programme at some stage in the future with part four. Just wanted to say thank you very much to Florian for coming
in.
Thank you. And introducing us to the strange full ceiling in the Deutsche Museum, which isn't dated 13,000 BC. It's dated, what is it, 1960?
This cave, yeah.
Yeah, this cave is 1960, yeah. Okay. 1960 cave painting. Also, thank you to Hannah Nurali for giving us a cover song, and Peter Jocelyn for giving us a Steely Dan song, and Dulcie Jocelyn for reading the monologue of the Kirchritters Archive curator in Hanover in a historically responsible way. This is Resonance FM, and I've got one more track to play, and then that's it.
Schwitters was the first artist to bring all his materials together into an abstract structure. He was working on this for over 10 or 15 years, creating an abstract installation where you could sleep, read, write letters, and where you could even present works by other artists. It was a very private space, though. And really the tragedy is that when he reached the point where he would have liked to present Merzbau to the public, more or less as a work, he couldn't, because there was a risk that the Nazis would come and destroy it. So he never really mentioned it anymore. He closed the door to it, and then went to Norway and lived with his son. Herme, his wife, stayed in Hanover, and one reason why she stayed in Hanover was to save the Merzbau from the Gestapo, who we knew came twice to the flat, but Herme managed to keep them out.